Hello, Doctor. This is your September monthly research report. I want to apologize to our French, German, Italian, and Spanish-speaking members, as obviously these research reports are in English. I'm not sure how we're going to resolve that, but our board will be working on that, and hopefully we'll have an amicable solution. This month's report will be a summary of key points discussed previously, the concepts of the vestibular ocular reflex deficit and the true presentation of the category 1, your right hamstring weakness and the clear emotional screenings, etc. First, I would like to say I am pleased to see that over 190 hits are on the monthly newsletter research report homepage. I've also received several emails. I was really hoping to stimulate more of a discussion with some comments about what is presented so far. I know some of these discussions are new to many of you, and how can there be such a discrepancy of understanding of especially the vestibular ocular reflex concept, especially as seen in the membership questionnaire that asks, do you believe everyone has a vestibular ocular problem? I'm interested in what your rationale is for your answer. And, of course, when we say vestibular ocular reflex, or VOR, what we're really talking about is the second half of the cranial injury component. The cranial injury component is made up of the labyrinthine ocular reflexes, eyes open and closed, and its associated tonic neck widening reflexes, eyes open and closed. The second half involves the vestibular ocular system, vestibular meaning inner ear, ocular eye muscles, and there we'll see the several steps involving the vestibular ocular right, left, up and down with the eyes, to tonic neck widening reflexes, to the ocular reflexes, tonic neck widening to the vestibular and tonic neck widening to sphenobasilar and pterygoids. I know most of you would be probably thinking that, well, this is what I was taught and that's what I do. And others may be thinking, well, isn't that the way all of us are wired? And others may simply not have given it much thought. On the contrary side, others may have been thinking, well, if the VOR is the foundation to learning disabilities, then everyone has a learning disability of some magnitude. Or if the VOR is the foundation of scoliosis, does everyone have a scoliosis of some sort? Or is the VOR a genetic thing, and what's the percentage of affliction in the general population? And what do other knowledgeable practitioners say about this? Well, let's go through and answer some of these concerns. First, is the VOR a genetic thing? Well, obviously, our organization and Dr. Furry did not have the funds to actually do full-scale genetic research. So we basically say that it's obviously a familial thing, which is just another way of saying genetic thing, meaning that if both parents have a vestibular ocular problem, their children or offspring will have a vestibular ocular problem. And if one parent has a vestibular ocular problem and the other one does not, then you get a statistical 50 to 75% of the children will have a vestibular ocular reflex deficit, and a percentage will not. And obviously, if both parents do not have a vestibular ocular problem, neither offspring or child would have a vestibular ocular problem. And, of course, we always have to add the other tidbit in is that we believe one can develop a vestibular ocular problem from a more significant or serious head trauma or trauma to the central nervous system, probably in the form of stroke or severe cranial injury, coma, et cetera. To my knowledge, I've only seen one case of that, of the latter, where I had a woman come in, young lady. I think she was in the late 20s, early 30s, and she came in with a history, says, I was brilliant in school. I went to college. Man, I got through 3 years of college. I was just doing fine, A's in all my courses, and I had scholarships. I had plans to go on to graduate school. In the summer, I was riding my bicycle. I crashed. I had a concussion. I ended up in the hospital. I was actually in a coma for several days. And after that, I went through rehabilitation, recovered essentially, but I could not go back to school. I tried going back to school. I couldn't do the work. I got lousy grades and eventually dropped out, and now I'm a gardener. How could that be? And when I did check her out, yes, there was the vestibular ocular component that we usually see, and the usual language processing problems of eye tracking, teeming, auditory processing, memory problems, etc. Plus, of course, the numerous musculoskeletal components with a significant gait distortion, etc. So although I didn't get a chance to see her before the accident, it's pretty clear cut from her history. And that's my sole example of that. Now, for the percentage of involved in the general population, I can only speak for what I've seen in my practice here in California, and it appears that about 65 to 70% of the population has this vestibular ocular problem. And I believe that is accurate, although you can say that people that have vestibular ocular problem would be more likely to have health concerns that brings them into the office, so that number could be a little higher. One could make that point. On the other hand, if you want to see a larger population of people that do not have a vestibular ocular problem, I think all you got to do is look at your major athletes, your Olympic competitors, your professional sport teams, your people in those categories, I believe, would not have a vestibular ocular problem, as a vestibular ocular problem, a balance and gait problem would inhibit them from excelling in their particular endeavor there. Before we leave our discussion on the vestibular ocular system, I wanted to bring your attention to an outstanding article in the ICAK Collected Papers of this year, and the article is written by Richard Belli. He's in Sacramento, California, and Richard is a teaching diplomat and diplomat in neurology, and well respected in the ICAK community. And he has a paper entitled Evaluation and Treatment of Dysfunctional Vestibular Ocular Reflexes, the Vestibular Spinal Reflexes, and vestibulocerebellar loops with manual muscle testing and manipulative therapies. That's his title. The abstract on that title, as I'm reading from the paper here, is the vestibular ocular reflexes, the vestibular spinal reflexes, VSR, vestibular cerebellar loops, VCL, are a very high priority in relationship of postural distortion, muscle tone balance, spinal function. Dysfunction of the VOR, VSR, and VCL can lead to imbalance of descending neurological activity to postural and spinal muscles, resulting in significant distortion with concomitant pain and dysfunction. Here, of course, I think he's just describing scoliosis without saying the word scoliosis. In the introduction part of his paper, he mentions that the vestibular system has four main functions: sensation, perception, position, and motion, orientating the head and body to vertical, controlling the body's center of mass, stabilizing head during postural movements. Next paragraph, the human vestibular system made up of three components: the peripheral sensory apparatus, meaning the mechanoreceptors in the body and the joints and muscles, the central processor, meaning, of course, the VOR, VSR, and VCL, and the mechanisms for motor output, i.e. the muscle movement. The output of the vestibular system goes to the ocular muscles, spinal cord, to serve as three important reflexes. The vestibular ocular, or VOR, the vestibulocolic, VCR, and the vestibulospinal, VSR. The VOR generates eye movements that enable clear vision while the head is in motion. The VCR acts as the neck musculature to stabilize the head on the neck. And, of course, the small suboccipital muscles primarily. I'm just adding that comment. The VCR generates compensatory body movement in order to maintain the head and posture stability and thereby preventing falls. I like what he has to say here. He certainly does a good job going into the real core neurology involved in the whole balance mechanism of the vestibular complex. It's an excellent paper. It is actually quite long. I'm looking at it, and it looks like there's 15 pages and three pages of references, or two pages of references. And in his paper, he goes on to talk about how to kinesiologically evaluate all these neurological components and what they mean when they fail and the consequences of that. He does an outstanding job in that. He reviews all the physiology and the neural pathways, which are very complex. And certainly if you really like to learn more about that whole complex and the neurology behind it, I would certainly recommend reading this paper. At the end of the paper, he goes into a lengthy flowchart to evaluate all the different components of that vestibular system. And it looks good. In the work that we do in neural organization technique, we kind of condense it down to a couple of simpler things and more with infinite emphasis on neurological correction than trying to identify each and every little pathway and where the aberration is. As I read through this, I didn't make any notation where he specifically says, and, of course, this would be the core neurology involved in scoliosis. He just relates it to all the commonality of neurology, of symptomatology that one has involving the musculoskeletal system involving any kind of gait, you know, weight-bearing activities, I should say. For those of you who may want to get a hold of this paper and are not members of ICAK, you could probably contact him in Sacramento. Looks like his phone number is 916-482-4150. His email is Sigmund, S-I-G-M-U-N-D, 01@msn.com. And he has a website, spectrumac.com, spectrumac.com. And again, this is Dr. Richard Belli in Sacramento. Next, what about scoliosis? Obviously, the vestibular ocular component is the key factor in scoliosis. But scoliosis is a bit more complex, and we're going to get into that when we, in probably two research reports forthcoming. So I think I'll hold off on that. until we get to those sections. Now, the VOR in their learning disabilities, well, I already discussed that, but obviously your vestibulo-ocular component is one of the foundational neurological components of the learning disability, but it does not, or at least it doesn't seem to be a significant variable in determining whether that language processing is mild, moderate, or severe. And, of course, we just have to insert that your language processing problems can be strictly emotional in nature, not a true learning, neurological learning disability of which this work is all about. And lastly is, what do other knowledgeable practitioners have to say about this question? So in discussing this concept with some local practitioners here in California that I know well, other practitioners that I've met in other chiropractic continuing education events, et cetera, I've asked them, do you believe everybody has a vestibulo-ocular problem? And the answer has just been very, very decisive in saying, of course not. How could everybody in the world have a problem? That some people do not have a vestibulo-ocular problem, and a significant percentage do, but many do not. And if you do not have a vestibulo-ocular problem, then there are no need to implement those steps in the cranial injury protocol. It makes things a lot simpler. You certainly do not have to do the scoliosis protocol, and of course, there will be no language processing protocol to work on these individual clients, patients. I personally would add, I would like to add one kind of note or caveat. Hopefully we'll get to this in future monthly reports, but there are three levels of involvement that I look at, and again, I'll go into this in greater detail in the future, but there's essentially present time, cumulative old stress patterns, and in relationship to. And that second one, cumulative old stress patterns, which is very, very briefly, is essentially all the micro-traumas that we've had since birth, or let's say as a toddler, learning how to stand and walk through your teenage years, et cetera. Minor traumas. And I believe all those traumas are incorporated into a kind of more like a singular memory of cumulative all stress patterns. And within that memory pattern, one can elicit the standard survival reflexes of the fight-flight system, the digestive system, not the digestive system, more the superficial immune system and the endocrine system. And within that fight-flight system, you will find a compensatory gait pattern, and there will be a kind of a scoliosis protocol embedded within that. It's a little complex, and I hope to go over that in greater detail in the future. Okay, now let's go look at the Category 1 concept. As I mentioned, that the Category 1 concept is a very complex neurological event, and it should be easily discernible if present and obvious when cleared. And failure to clear it correctly will, of course, result in a return of your gait reflexes and cranial injury component, et cetera. In the recent Applied Kinesiology, International College of Applied Kinesiology collected papers of this year, there was one paper titled Category 1 as a symptom of hyperinsulinism and or dysfunction of the tonic labyrinthine reflex, a theory of idiopathic scoliosis origins. by Philip Cameron. This was a short three-page paper that I thought was interesting. And let's see if I could read you a little bit from it here. The Category 1 pelvic dysfunction is a structural dysfunction described by Dr. Walser in Applied Kinesiology, Synopsis, second edition, as torsion of the pelvis without osseous misalignment at the sacroiliac articulations. This paper proposes that Category 1 is actually a symptom of hyperinsulinism and or dysfunction of the tonic labyrinthine reflexes. This paper also proposes that the above to be a possible theory for the origin of idiopathic scoliosis. And what I like about this paper, of course, is it goes into a good discussion about Category 1. There are some things I don't quite believe in, or is not of my opinion. I haven't seen any significant evidence of hyperinsulinism resulting in this Category 1 concept, and the concept of Category 1 being a significant factor in idiopathic scoliosis. And I'll get into that more, but I'll say for now that I don't believe pelvic injuries and pelvic problems have anything to do with scoliosis. It's more of an upper brain function problem. But what I do like is this discussion about the concept of Category 1 as it relates to gait imbalances. And here he talks about if Category 1 is present, and I'm reading from his paper here, have the patient stand and begin evaluation of abnormal gait patterns using standard AK techniques. In other words, evaluate for normal inhibition of the latissimus on the ipsilateral side of the posterior gait and inhibition of the pec major clavicula on the contralateral side. At the conclusion of his paper, he tries to make the point that if you have this abnormal gait pattern, you have to have Category 1. That abnormal gait pattern is abnormal gait pattern of the pec major clavicular and ipsilateral latissimus dorsi weakness that I just described can be the foundation, or he believes is the foundation for your scoliosis. That means that Category 1 is a key factor in scoliosis. And I applaud him on his theory in looking at this. I think he's close. He's not quite correct in that we all know that everybody has a Category 1 involving, or at least the Category 1 presentation when we look at the fight-flight system, that can be corrected, and those individuals may or may not have scoliosis. But it was a good discussion. And last, I would like to discuss the screening protocol outlined in the May 2012 research report. The screening protocol is an attempt to assist the practitioner and initially evaluating the patient, determine what's the most appropriate therapeutic approach for the day, and certainly taking into consideration the individual symptomatology and whether this is the first visit or follow-up visits. That's a lot of clinical information to kind of juggle and correlate to decide what you want to do, and I think the more successful you are at that, the more efficient you are as a practitioner, and the better results that you will get. I mention this because this plays a critical role in my evaluation and treatment in clinical practice, in that I want to know in advance what my strategy is for this individual client and the time allocated for the visits, and is there anything urgent that I need to do before I continue on with care, and from what I did in the prior visits, or in the alternative case, if it's an initial visit, looking at their, you know, listening to their symptomatology and their complaints, and then deciding what would be the most effective protocol or work to be done on that initial visit. So let's run through a couple of scenarios here to give you a better idea. It would be nice to have kind of videos of this, and maybe we will, maybe I will do that in the future. Possibly the final research reports will just go through videos of patient treatments. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Okay, let's run through a couple of quick scenarios here. Here, let's say a new patient is coming in their first visit. They have lots of musculoskeletal complaints, neck, back, maybe some headaches, maybe some radicular pain, etc. And so right away you're thinking that you want to go through the fight-flight system, in other words, the gait reflexes, cranial injury complex, etc., and that would be the most appropriate thing to do. Then consequently, you look and you identify that there's a lot of emotional stress factors involved. You could see on the prior protocol, we looked at five levels, the stomach neurovascular points being level one, right jaw being level two, endocrine system involvement with involvement of either the heart or stomach as the recipient organs of those stress, level three, level four, the sphenoid tilt on the right, and level five, crown chakra or energy collapse of the system. So in this situation, as I described, level one and two involvement would be irrelevant, and because level two would be cleared up during the defensive jaw treatment. If they have level three and it's the cardiac back component, that could be a very significant reason for their musculoskeletal complaints, especially if they mention there's a flare-up involved. So one may want to proceed by looking at the emotional factors, meaning neutralize the defensive jaw, go through the endocrine system and cardiac back, and that could be, and then clear the emotional factors at the end. That could be an excellent initial visit, even though you have not gone through the formal fight-flight system, you know, from Category 1 to Category 2. What you're doing is just implementing and going after what's the causative of their acute symptomatology, and that would be an excellent therapeutic intervention on the first visit. Follow-up visits, if that's clear, then you can go, you know, continue on into the fight-flight system, meaning the Category 1 gait reflexes, et cetera. Another possible scenario, if someone's just coming in for just general health care and just has a lot of miscellaneous vague complaints, the practitioner has their choice of where to begin. They could certainly, time allowed, go through, you know, the fight-flight system of the physical body, meaning Category 1, gait reflexes, et cetera, and continue on for as much time as they have. Or if time is limited, you may want to go for a shorter protocol. I would suggest going through the superficial immune system, meaning starting off prone, C7, T1, T11, T12, L1, and the superficial immune system, turning the person over and going through the rest of the immune system off of spleen 21. These are, of course, topics we haven't gotten to yet, and we will. Universal jaw and digestive jaw if time allows. And that would be an excellent initial visit. I often will do that. That probably would take less than 20 minutes. And I should also mention that would probably be my choice in approach if someone came in with symptoms of somatovisceral complaints, in other words, digestive problems or allergy problems or just internal organ problems, because doing that will certainly have an effect on those systemic issues. Another approach here is what I at least observe a lot, and I mean at least 75% of the time, someone coming in with either musculoskeletal complaints or more commonly systemic type of complaints, digestive problems, hormonal issues, language processing problems, especially all chronic conditions. If they present with all four or five levels of those emotional stress factors that I mentioned, and the key factor is if they're at level four, and certainly level five. Level four meaning the sphenoid is involved, and when that's present, that takes high priority because it's draining their vitality, their energy level, so they're certainly going to have complaints of fatigue, and it has the potential to aggravate any and all other symptomatology, even if it's a toxicity problem, heavy metal toxicity or whatever. I think that's a high priority and needs to be addressed. I'm not at this point going to go in how to treat that. I believe some of that was covered in that May report, but we'll probably have a separate research report with that, and there certainly will be a need for a video demonstration of that. But I would consider that a high priority because it has such a widespread effect systemically and energy-wise, hormonally-wise. And, of course, most commonly with that is going to be the cardiac back factor anyway. And I hope that gives you some insight. The next report in October, I think we will proceed with the defensive jaw. And if there's time, we'll add on to that the fascial defense. And when we do that, we're going to add we're going to introduce a new concept on how to correct that. And I think you'll find it very, very interesting. And I look forward to continuing this conversation with you in October. Have a good holidays, and good luck to you, Laurent, and in your presentation in the Montreal ICAK meeting, and where he's going to present to the ICAK people and members and board some of the concepts of NOT. And thank you for those that have completed the application and those that are planning to do that soon, and the generous voluntary contribution from Dr. Richard Forzon here in California. And thank you again, and see you in October. Bye.